You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Opening Act, Hail the King. Kingsley Ben-Adir takes the lead, One Hero at a Time, by Britt Hennemuth, with photograph by Amber Pinkerton. The London-born actor Kingsley Ben-Adir has stolen hearts in culty streamers like The OA and High Fidelity. This fall, he's playing two of America's greats, Barack Obama in Showtime's The Comey Rule miniseries, then Malcolm X, and Regina King's Toronto International Film Festival-bound One Night in Miami. With both projects gaining election-year momentum, Ben-Adir is having as much fun working as you are watching him. The son of a musician father and caregiver mother, Ben-Adir's only connection to acting was his grandfather. He was an extra in Little Shop of Horrors. There was a signed picture from Rick Moranis in my grandma's living room. With three projects out this fall, including AMC's new anthology show, Soulmates, he's reflecting on advice from his Guildhall drama teacher. The first 5 years of acting is just experience. After 10, then you really start. He smiles. It's effing 10 years on the dot. His first job was Soldier Number 1 in Brad Pitt's World War Z. Can we have Soldiers 1, 2, and 3 to rehearse with Brad? As we were coming down, they said, Soldier 1's been cut. But the first assistant director had paid attention, and some other lines came up for me later. He recites them. I'll never forget. Of his two controversially canceled television series, I think the OA's gone to bed, he says, but admits surprise for Zoe Kravitz, High Fidelity. I would imagine there would have been a happy ending for his and Kravitz's characters, Mac and Rob. In January, he shot Obama and Malcolm X at the same time, flying back and forth from New Orleans and Toronto, a 40-day nonstop shoot. Every hour was really important. Dialect was his touchstone for Obama. He's one of the most recognizable voices on the planet. It would be cool to play him again in 20 years. In time, I'm sure there will be a movie that's all about him. He hopes to portray a nuanced Malcolm X. I'm of the belief that he was actually very kind and gentle, not the lacerating demagogue, a father, a husband. With this movie, people are going to start weighing where we're at. When Malcolm says, Black people are dying in the streets, how much has changed? Terror on television. Most on-screen horror can't rival this year's real-world insanity, but that doesn't mean we don't like to watch. Here, three nail-biters. Monsterland, Hulu. This anthology series, based on Nathan Ballingrud's Lovecraftian story collection, North American Lake Monsters, opens with Caitlin Dever as a waitress and single mom, whisked off her feet by a stranger with a gory secret. The Walking Dead, World Beyond AMC. In a two-season spinoff, this coming-of-age story takes place a decade post-apocalypse and sees two teenage girls grappling with growing up and zombies. The second presidential debate, ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox. I have a winning temperament, Trump bellowed on the 2016 presidential debate stage. This election cycle has the biggest monster running scared. On to fashion and beauty. Daisy Shaw Ellis gives us just the ticket with photograph by Ariel Bob Willis showing a B. Moncler Richard Quinn trench coat, leggings, and shoes all matching in a cornflower blue floral print. Bright poppy flowers and a cozy, cool coat are opposite sides of the seasonal scale. But who doesn't love a good balancing act? This fuzzy jacket, made in collaboration with maximalist British designer Richard Quinn for the Moncler Genius Project, embraces a mod shape while utilizing Quinn's hallmark prints. With the weather turning and global outlook less than jolly, the right costuming will teeter your totter. Trending primary source. On gray October days, take inspiration from the clean lines and crisp tones of Piet Mondrian's composition with red, blue, black, yellow, and gray, the perfect blend of playful abstraction and pure geometry. Bright ideas, a coach skirt, Poketo bamboo salad plate in blots, set of four, Roger Vivier boots, off-white, care of Virgil Abloh, blazer, sweater, shoes, and bag, Michael Kors collection dress, Valentino Voce Viva perfume, Fernando Jorge bracelet, Saint Laurent by Anthony Vaccarello bag, NYX professional makeup, SFX face and body paint palette, Fendi men's jacket. Piet Mondrian's influential paintings will be on view in the forthcoming exhibit, Mondrian and Estée, at Madrid's Museo Nacional Central de Arte Reina Sofía. Laura Regensdorf writes on beauty, a high note. In a new book, perfume publisher Frédéric Malle reflects on his creative roots and the art of heady collaborations. When Frederick Malle created his perfume house 20 years ago, the industry was rife with cookie-cutter scents by hired hands. He wanted to give talented noses a platform, showing that these people were more than ghostwriters. They were authors, he says. Legacy aside, Malle's grandfather founded Christian Dior Parfum. His father and uncle, Louis Malle, made films. The self-styled publisher broke norms and won fans, with instant icons like Maurice Roussel's simmering Musc Ravageur, a new Rizzoli book, Edition de Parfum Frederick Malle, brims with piquant details. A teenage Malle doused in Eau Sauvage and illuminates what he calls perfumery's left-brain, right-brain type of dance, with archival photos, text exchanges, and whimsical comic strips. In the photos, Malle at work, riding behind his father and brother in France, a new edition of Dominique Rapion's Portrait of a Lady. Gallinard books were an early design inspiration, a scene from Edition de Parfum Frederick Malle, the first 20 years. The Shift Key. To create Byredo's debut makeup collection, founder Ben Gorham tapped London makeup artist Isimaya Franch for a future-forward lineup. Let's talk about corporate color, Isimaya Franch chirps through the screen on a Zoom session, referring to a sculptural eyeshadow palette, a set of office-appropriate neutrals cheekily identified as such. The editorial makeup artist behind the smeared red lips at Junya Watanabe's Fall 2020 show and Rihanna's face tattoo on May's British Vogue cover is known for technical rigor and offbeat glamour, which is why Byredo's Ben Gorham invited her to team up for the fragrance brand's first foray into color. Along with clean, ingredient lipsticks and artfully curved mascara, the line includes 16 color sticks, multi-use formulas, from glossy pink to iridescent blue, that feel like true novelties inside and out. Relics inspired the packaging, says Gorham. Ancient objects, almost alien in nature and super futurist. Lash impressions. Genetics has given Jenna Lyons precious few eyelashes. I have maybe 3 on one side and 5 on the other, she explains. They're so cute, says makeup artist Toi Olivier, who spent years on set with Lyons during her reign as creative director of J. Crew. Love Scene, their new false lash brand, expands the category beyond its over-the-top reputation with 10 versatile styles that consider eye shape and ethnicity. A densely fluffy set pops against dark skin. Wispier ones with a clear base suit the fair-haired. Plus, a sleek tool arriving this month aims to make application easy. In the photos, Olivier and Lyons, Kate with a clear lash line, and the doll-like Axel. Laura Regensdorf takes us on a field trip. Kitchen Whisperer, with photographs by Kyoko Hamada. Hawa Hassan, whose line of sauces reflects her native Somalia, finds connection at home in Brooklyn. For me, when I have such joy and where I pull a lot of my strength, is just being in kitchens with women. Commotion and stillness at the same time, says Hawa Hassan, founder of the condiments line Basbas. Her story could fill a book. Childhood in Mogadishu, a year in a UN refugee camp in Kenya, followed by a solo voyage to Seattle at age 7. But it's matriarchs who take the spotlight in Bibi's Kitchen, a compilation of East African recipes out this month. At Hassan's Brooklyn apartment, those spice blends prove their versatility. She uses her own chutney on Mexican takeout and encourages you to do the same. In the photos, Hassan's original basbas sauces. 4 more will join this fall. The globe is a reminder that at my desk the world is possible, she says. Two ingredients in the line's coconut cilantro chutney. The cover of In Bibi's Kitchen, published by Ten Speed Press, written with Julia Tertian. A diary from her New York modeling years, beginning in 2005. A figurine given by a friend who co-runs 14 Plus Foundation, which builds schools in Zambia. And smiling kitchen tools from the Japanese home goods shop Daiso. And this from Caitlin Brody, Knowledge Base. Luca Guadagnino annotates a script page from his first television series. Italian filmmaker Luca Guadagnino ventured into uncharted waters twice over with his new HBO series, We Are Who We Are, his first foray into television, and the first project for which he traded his typical 35mm film for digital, because he says this is a show about the here and now. The series, premiering September 14th, takes place on an American military base in Italy during the lead-up to Trump's election and centers on two teenagers exploring identity, sexuality, and family dynamics. At the end of the day, no one really knows who he is. She is. They are, Guadagnino says. It's always a transition that we live through. In the photos, shot on set by Collier Shore, actors Jordan Christine Simon and Jack Dylan Grazer depict friends and army brats Caitlin and Fraser. The series also features notable faces like Kid Cudi, Alice Braga, and Chloe Sevigny as Fraser's mother, pictured here. First Lady Files, Costume Drama. After 4 years and endless speculation, Melania Trump's Fashion Rarely Says Anything by Kenzie Bryant. With opening photo illustration by Michelle Thompson. As Melania Trump has acclimated to the office, her dressing choices have not become more nuanced, but instead deepened into costume, and shown here in the photos are some examples. Donald Trump's second State of the Union, delivered in January 2018, included the specter of immigrant gangs, the importance of saluting the flag, and the glory of his tax cuts. But that's not what stuck with the viewing public. So many of us had by then grown inured to these monologues. Instead, that chilly Tuesday night is better remembered for his wife, First Lady Melania Trump, who entered the room wearing a white pantsuit, shining among the sober Washington palette. The speculation began immediately. Was it some kind of dig at Hillary Clinton, who favored white pantsuits as a nod to suffragettes, or a comment about this being Melania's first appearance since the Stormy Daniels scandal broke? Was it somehow about the Me Too movement? According to Melania's old friend Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, it was none of the above. A former Vogue special events director, Winston Wolkoff knew the Trumps from the Manhattan charity gala circuit and was the rare New York society figure who followed them to Washington. She helped plan the inauguration and then settled into a role as an East Wing advisor. She left her post in 2018 as the Trump's inauguration spending drew increased scrutiny and allegations of self-dealing. She has said she was thrown under the bus, and in Melania and Me, a memoir released in September, details her front-row seat to the alleged bus thrower's ascendance to the halls of American power. It was not as if Melania was unaware of the potential message her State of the Union pantsuit might broadcast, Winston Wolkoff told me this summer. The former East Wing advisor tried to dissuade Melania from wearing it, but the more I begged, the more she laughed it off. Melania doesn't think about the why of her fashion choices and what she is wearing, Winston Wolkoff said. She laughs off the press's attempts to decipher meaning from her clothing. It does seem laughable, all this attention on the First Lady's clothes and stagecraft and optics. But that's so much of politics, and especially this particular office, which is as undefined as it is unelected. These women, because they have all been women, have the ear of the president, and they can spend their time in the East Wing largely as they see fit. Almost a full term into her husband's presidency, Melania has charted a path unique to modern inhabitants of the East Wing. It took her about 4.5 months to even occupy the space, which she finally did after hinting early on that she might stay put in New York. Her pet issue, an ill-defined childhood wellness platform, included an anti-bullying pillar, an ironic add-on to say the least. Her predecessors have been regulars on late night and morning shows and have at times lobbied Congress on behalf of their own initiatives, but Melania has taken a more reserved tack. She's agreed to an interview here and there, but otherwise she lets the photos talk. Carl Sferazza Anthony, historian at the National First Ladies Library, said the amount of attention paid to what a first lady wears ebbs and flows, depending on a number of factors, and all first ladies have contended with it. But the focus is also particular to the family that Melania married into. In Trumpland, image is always the first thing, and for the extraordinarily reticent Melania, it can seem the only thing. For a former fashion model first lady, that's fitting in a neat kind of way. But Melania's aesthetics are also particularly reflective of her husband's approach to life and governing. She has a habit of choosing pieces almost too thematically appropriate for the event, so that it comes off like she's starring in a film about a first lady doing the things first ladies do. Early on, she wore a lumberjack-style shirt while toiling in the White House vegetable garden. She wore a plaid cape, going full Mrs. Claus, to receive a Christmas tree. She wore a Cheongsam-style gown to dine alongside Chinese President Xi Jinping. Gucci, an Italian brand, made the garment. As she settled into her office, the outfits did not become more nuanced, but deepened into costume. In Kenya, part of her first big solo trip as First Lady, she wore a pith helmet, a gesture largely derided as colonialist caricature. She can go from out of Africa to Top Gun in an instant, too. Whereas her husband tends to want and succeeded at least once in getting military vehicles to accompany him at events for that certain je ne sais dictator, it's Melania who manages the salute-worthy paramilitary look. She wears army green and aviators to greet the troops or visit hurricane cleanup. Speaking at the Republican National Convention in August, she was a Banana Republic commandant in olive green Alexander McQueen. Over and over, Melania's style highlights the shortcomings of the administration's familial contingent, from Ivanka to Jared Kushner to Trump himself. They dress for the job they want when they already have it. In the Trump White House, the campaign never ended, and the actual work never began. So, why, more than 3 years in, does she still dress as if she's on stage in five? Melania has largely served as her own style director, according to both Winston Wolkoff and the East Wing Chief of Staff and short-lived White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham, though designer Hervé Pierre helps as well. It's a job made more difficult by the early rush among some luxury brands, like Tom Ford and Marc Jacobs, to distance themselves from the First Lady. Michael Kors made a point to note that if she was wearing one of his items, she bought it at retail. Winston Wolkoff had to lean on relationships with fashion houses from her years producing the Met Gala at Vogue and then marshaling New York Fashion Week at Lincoln Center. I found myself frequently asking for a favor, not offering one, she said. Any attempt to assign meaning to a given outfit, beyond the very obvious, doesn't take. Melania wore another vaguely militaristic coat to her husband's third State of the Union in February. Women's Wear Daily reached out to Pierre and asked if that was some kind of attempted fashion diplomacy, given the designer, Burberry this time. A show of support for England as it tried to extricate itself from the European Union, perhaps. It has nothing to do with England or Brexit, he told the fashion trade. If I would have to think of all these things when I look at dresses and outfits, I would lose my mind. He has a point. The definition of insanity is trying to divine meaning from the First Lady's taste, time and again, and expecting to find something, anything at all. Melania's style, as arresting as it is, mostly is just in line with the general Trumpian aesthetic. A kind of American kitsch that privileges gloss over heft, itself over anything else. Winston Wolkoff recalled trying to work with reporters around the inauguration in 2017. For example, arranging an exclusive on the design with Women's Wear Daily, a time-honored fashion tradition. She saw something meaningful in the fact that two immigrants, Melania and Pierre, had designed the inaugural gown together. But mentioning immigration in this context was a non-starter. Stephanie Grisham advised Melania not to provide an exclusive to WWD, and that was that. I never shut anything down. Mrs. Trump is in charge, Grisham told me. In her first moments as First Lady, Melania had relinquished the chance to shape the narrative. The fashion press and public were left to divine from afar. There may be one incident when Melania broke from this routine and tried to say something with her clothes. "You knew we'd get here eventually. The infamous Zara, I really don't care, do you, Jacket?" The statement, literally written on her back as she traveled to visit immigrant children separated from their parents by her husband's administration in 2018, was more confusing than anything. Grisham said at the time that it meant nothing. It was just a jacket. Months later, the First Lady contradicted the official line in a rare interview, telling Tom Yamas of ABC that she continued to wear the jacket because the media was obsessed with it. In Winston Wolkoff's telling, it was a troll. She recalls Melania joking, "I'm driving liberals crazy. You know what? They deserve it." The epic failure of that jacket was not that she wore it, but that she, through her press secretary, had the opportunity to explain what the intention was, and instead became very defensive, said Anthony. Even when Melania's clothes have had literal words on them, they communicated nothing at all. The outfits are ultimately only symbols, really. They don't matter in any kind of material sense, especially as we wrap on the first term of a presidency that has hurt so many of those it is duty-bound to protect. But as symbols, they have proven incredibly useful in their way, reminding us time and again that she's a member of a troop of upstarts desperate to look the part, play-acting at running the country. love, actually. In its new season, The Crown tackles the saga of Prince Charles and Diana Spencer. Julie Miller catches up with actors Emma Corrin and Josh O'Connor about portraying one of the most famous and ill-fated couples of the 20th century. Photographs by Brett Lloyd, styled by Tom Guinness. Opening photo, star-crossed. Emma Corrin and Josh O'Connor were photographed for Vanity Fair at Rye Manor, Kent, UK. The first time Diana Spencer appears on screen in the fourth season of Netflix's The Crown, she's 16 and trying to blend into the scenery. It's 1977. Prince Charles has come to pick up her older sister, Sarah. Diana, still wearing a tree costume from a school play, wants to see but not be seen, so she tries hiding in some foliage. But even as a teenager, the future Lady Di, played by eerily resemblant newcomer Emma Corrin, is unmissable. Charles, played by Josh O'Connor, can't help but fall into her magnetic pull. "She's just such an extraordinary character," said Peter Morgan, the Oscar, Emmy, and Tony-nominated screenwriter and creator of The Crown, who has spent the last decade and a half since his film The Queen imagining what Buckingham Palace looks like behind the scenes. She was very much the British Eva Peron, such a mythic figure, so much bigger than anything we'd been used to. The first three seasons of the Netflix drama plumbed dark palace halls and cold Windsor hearts, wringing emotion from unspoken words, unfulfilled ambitions and affections, and other collateral damage of constitutional duty. But Corrin's Diana burst into the series in a cloud of naivete, baggy jumpers, and Stevie Nicks songs, ready for a fairy tale, only to be served a depressing reality. Her prince? His heart already belongs to Camilla Parker Bowles. Her new family? Aloof and disinterested. Her palace? A posh prison. Diana's heart-wrenching season 4 storyline follows her from her fast-tracked courtship to her marital dissolution, with stops in motherhood, in-law clashes, and affairs along the way. "You really see her turn from a girl into a woman," says Corrin, the 24-year-old Brit cast in the iconic role. Elizabeth Debicki will continue the Princess Diana transformation when she succeeds Corrin for The Crown's final two seasons. We see her before she goes into the palace, when she is living with her flatmates, and how normal she was before she was plucked from obscurity. As fate would have it, the actor's mother, Juliette Corrin, a speech therapist, grew up being told that she resembled the late princess. Corrin herself worked as a model while she was at university, collecting a handful of acting roles along the way, the most significant of which was as the love interest on Pennyworth, the origin story of Bruce Wayne's butler, Alfred. Several years ago, Corrin received an unexpected invitation from The Crown's casting directors, not to audition, but to be a scene partner for actors reading for the character of Parker Bowles. Corrin bore such a similarity to the lapis-eyed Diana and affects her coy smile so easily that Morgan says everyone was transfixed. When it came time to film, she was outfitted in a feathered blonde wig, demure makeup, and a trousseau of impeccably recreated costumes that telegraphed the princess's arc from frumpy school aide to high-end fashion plate. The transformation was so total that even months after shooting, O'Connor says that when he sees a photo of the real-life princess, his first reaction is, "Oh, look, there's Emma." Charles, in season 4, is no longer the sympathetic character wrestling with themes of responsibility and duty that he was in season 3. His performance was so compelling that O'Connor said both Bradley Cooper and Alec Baldwin reached out to him as fans. The Charles of season 4 is more flawed, hopelessly in love with a woman he can't marry, while married to a woman he can't seem to love. To prepare, O'Connor read about arranged marriages and the psychology of marital breakdowns. "I'm more wary of marriage now," he says with a laugh. Corin, meanwhile, researched the late princess hungrily, reading about her traumatic childhood, littering her computer desktop with screen grabs from the documentary Diana, in her own words, and installing a photo of Diana with Prince Philip as her computer backdrop. When Corin acquired a cockapoo puppy, she named him Spencer. The actor also spoke to Diana's private secretary, Patrick Jeffson. "Something he said was how happy she was," says Corin. "Obviously, there was a tragic strain throughout her life, which you feel very much in the series. She had so much heartbreak, loss, and loneliness, but Patrick said that her natural inclination was towards happiness." Corin tried to reflect that lightness in scenes of Diana with her children. Diana interacting with the public, or Diana simply listening to music and dancing. Another question Corin asked Jeffson was whether he believed Diana truly loved Charles. Jeffson, says Corin, did not hesitate to respond. "Undoubtedly, to the very, very end," says Corin. "Honestly, that breaks my heart completely," Patrick said. "Even when they were fighting and getting the divorce, her only concern was that Charles was all right." Morgan wove the same theme into his scripts for the show. "I don't think she ever stopped loving Charles," he says. "I think she had grown to realize that marriage was impossible. I think she may have loved other people towards the end of it, but I think her number one choice would have been to make that marriage work." In addition to delving into the couple's affairs, Morgan depicts Diana's battle with bulimia, a mode of self-harm that can be difficult to portray in all of its shadings on screen. "It just struck me that to not represent it would be to deny the former Princess of Wales some of the true complexity of her character," says Morgan. "Her own suffering made her have compassion for other people, and it was the compassion she showed for other people that was what made everyone love her. Everyone has vulnerabilities and frailties, and she wore hers on her sleeve, which, of course, is the opposite of royalty. You're representing an idea and an ideal, and you don't want there to be too much humanity in the way." The Crown's fourth season spans the late 1970s to the early 1990s, and also examines the fascinating relationship between Queen Elizabeth, played by Olivia Colman, and Margaret Thatcher, played by Gillian Anderson. With Thatcher, Elizabeth was contending not only with her first female PM, but also with a contemporary. "When I found out that they were born only 6 months apart, that was a big breakthrough for me," says Morgan. "Because of their generation, they had a lot of things in common. They're both very resilient, very committed, work incredibly hard, have an extraordinary sense of duty. They both have a strong Christian faith. They're both girls of the war generation who switch the lights off when they leave a room. But then, they had such different ideas about running the country." It is tragic to see two women in such rare positions of power, both of them trying to parent adult children and navigate male egos, both at home and at work, struggle to connect. Morgan knew that casting Thatcher would be crucial. He needed an actor imposing enough to hold her own opposite Colman, the Oscar-winning star of The Favourite. As it happened, he was dating Anderson, the Emmy-winning X-Files actor who resembles Thatcher from certain angles. Morgan proceeded delicately. He suggested Anderson to casting director Nina Gold, but only, he insisted, if Gold considered her the best person for the part. The Crown filmed most of its fourth season before the coronavirus outbreak, then lost several weeks of production because of the lockdown. Knowing that filming would be on hold for months, Morgan cannily restructured the episodes. The truth is, yes, we are missing at least 2 weeks of filming, he says, about having to make do. I just hope you can't tell where. Morgan avoids dwelling on contemporary royal headlines while filming, but as he was making the new season, two erupted. The first was increased scrutiny over Prince Andrew's relationship with late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Writing an episode in which the Queen re-examines her relationship with each of her young adult children, Morgan laid the groundwork for the present-day scandal only sparingly. If you draw too many intentional parallels, it actually becomes quite ugly. The second blaring headline, of course, was Meghan Markle's difficulty adjusting to the royal family, and her and husband Harry's eventual split from the monarchy. When you see a beautiful young princess struggling to find love and acceptance within the family, the parallels are obvious, and the parallels write themselves, he says. If you come into the royal family with any agenda for yourself, or if you come in and connect with the public in a way that threatens to change the way that the royal family connects with the public, that's something that doesn't particularly sit comfortably for either side. Really, the only version of events that works is if somebody comes in and becomes invisible and just sort of knuckles down to a lifetime of agreeable supplicancy to the duties of the crown. Diana struggled to fit in with the institution in a way that it's impossible not to see the parallels with Meghan Markle and Harry. So the story feels both incredibly vivid historically, but also it really shines a lot of lights on where we are now. In upcoming podcasts, we'll have the cover story with Elle Fanning, an article about Gabby Giffords, and the Proust questionnaire with Vera Wang. All that and more in upcoming installments of Vanity Fair magazine, right here on the North Carolina Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.